Now, Peter Ward is a professor of biology, and this hour we're going to talk about the biological effects of that oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. Peter's also the author of Life as We Do Not Know It and Under a Green Sky. We'll be back with Peter in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Now, as I was mentioning, Peter Ward is a professor of biology, a professor of earth and space sciences, and an adjunct professor of astronomy at the University of Washington in Seattle. And he is the principal investigator of the University of Washington's node of the NASA Astrobiology Institute. And here he is this hour on Coast to Coast AM. Peter, welcome back. How are you?
I wish I had better news.
Yeah, I know that.
Me when good things happen.
What a disaster of biblical proportions, Peter, isn't it?
Yeah. You know what? I've been going through the net trying to get realistic figures about exactly how much oil is coming out. And it's amazing the disparity you get all over the map, not just on what is coming out now, but the estimates about what is about to come out. As far as I can tell, BP has closed off one of the three major leaks, but House of Representatives people believe it's going to go up to as much as 40 to 60,000 gallons a day from the 5,000 gallons or so that's coming out now. And so it's just all over the map.
This is a disaster, not only for public relations, for those who support drilling in the Gulf, but it's an environmental disaster. Now, let's talk a little bit, Peter, if we can, biologically, what's going on there? What's getting affected?
Well, it could not have hit in really much of a worse place. The Alaska oil spill was very bad as well, but this one, in a way, is worse because you're dealing with a big body of water, the Gulf of Mexico, in which there isn't a great deal of circulation on the bottom. Because of this, the Gulf has already experienced over the last decade something that we call dead zones. It's not a Stephen King. It's an actual area where oxygen is completely removed from the water, killing all bottom life. And so you've got a situation where you have already a very nasty sort of fetid aquarium setup where that oil cannot be broken up by a lot of bottom agitation. And worse yet, it is in a situation where you have very little oxygen, therefore bacteria that could otherwise help destroy it can't grow. So we're adding a really nasty whammy onto a body of water that has already taken a lot of hits. And the reason is dead zones are there is you have all this fertilizer coming down the Mississippi. The phosphates and nitrates are used up by algae in the water, and boom, dead bottom.
Now, they do a lot of shrimp harvesting in that area too, don't they?
Well, they do, and that's in the very shallow water. Now, down deep, there's no oxygen left, so the shrimp are already gone. And yet, nevertheless, the shallows, because of the same Mississippi, because you have all this really rich shallow water fertilizer coming down in the mud of the surfaces, yes, you have an enormous amount of productivity. And that is just the real problem why this is such a double whammy. First, you have a low oxygen bottom, but secondly, let's look back at Alaska. When that oil hit the beach there, it was on rocks. And you saw all these pictures of these guys with these great big scrubbers and steam hoses, detergent, washing the rocks off. There's no rocks here. It's all mud. There's nothing to wash off. That oil hits the mud. It sinks into the mud. How do you clean it? You could pick up all the mud, but there isn't enough trucks in the world to carry all that mud away.
And you know what? The oil will stay there for how long? How long?
Well, that's a great point. Right now, I've been going back. The biggest oil spill of all time was done by Saddam Hussein, and he let loose over 100 square miles of oil 5 inches thick. This still dwarfs, according to that. I mean, this is even the Alaska Valdez wasn't anywhere close to that. But Saudi Arabia, where most of that oil washed up on, it washed up on a very deserted beach, and no one has really followed that in the 20 years since. There's just really no sense of what has happened to that other than it appears to still be there. So I really don't see, decades are going to take place before there's an appreciable diminution of it, at least in the mud. In Alaska now, there's still a heck of a lot of oil sitting there. And in this particular case, I just really see this hurting the shrimp, at least, and the fish industry in a really already depressed economy for a very great long time.
You know, it convinces me, Peter, at how mankind, by screwing around, can do something that is so disruptive to the planet. I mean, what are they going to do next? Drill into the core of the planet and toss off our rotation or what?
You know? Well, isn't it ironic that it just happened a month or so after President Obama decided, okay, let's open up drilling everywhere now. We need the oil. You know, our representatives don't have the courage to go in and say, let's attack this foreign oil problem. Every administration says, this is a problem, let's fix it, and no one can. Maybe, I don't know, how many wake-up calls do we need?
You know what? Probably not too many, but for some reason, we just never seem to wake up, Peter.
Well, this is a bad one. This is going to hurt a lot. And in terms of biological remediation, we're making a lot of progress on, again, having bacteria help break down oil. But we're not there yet. It isn't as if we can take a magic bullet and dump it all over this or, you know, take a little pill and fix it. I mean, that's just not in the cards on this one. And again, you're going to have your shrimp curry now, listeners, because the price of shrimp is just about to go out the window.
It is going to go through the roof. And if you eat shrimp that has a little oil flavor to it, don't eat.
Oh, that's horrible.
Oh, but it's possible. Peter, what percent? Do you know what percent of shrimp we get from the Gulf and other regions of this planet?
I do not. I certainly know that an awful lot of shrimp lately are coming out of aquaculture in various areas. But the Gulf is certainly the biggest reservoir of native marine shrimp. An awful lot of the stuff we're getting these days is coming out of really nasty freshwater pools. A lot are coming out of the Philippines. A lot are coming out of other tropical countries. But really the best tasting shrimp are marine shrimp. And this has been just a, you know, Forrest Gump. You saw it in the movie.
Yeah.
Bubba Gump is going to have some real problems now because this is going to just take the bottom out of our shrimp industry.
And that's not the only problem here, Peter. What about the coastlines, the beachfronts? You know, how close will it get to, let's say, to the South Beach, Miami area? I mean, can all these places be affected?
Well, it depends on weather. Now, if we come rolling into we're out of hurricane season, thank goodness. Can you imagine if we had a hurricane then hitting this thing at the same time?
Yeah, but we're going into one, right? We're going into hurricane season June 1st.
Well, yeah, but it's still early May. I mean, the hope is that at the moment we can squeak through this and not get hit by an early one, because that would really change the whole thing. And again, I go back to the Alaska oil situation. There, the coastline is fairly steep. I've seen that place. You've got rocks and you've got beach, but then it goes up into a nice shingle and you've got higher ground. The problem with this whole Gulf area is that it is endless numbers of small streams, anastomosing. They're like this breakup reticular structure where you have hundreds or thousands and then tens of thousands of tiny little streams. The oil goes up every one of those streams with a little bit higher tide and a little bit lower tide, and then sinks into that mud. You don't have any purchase for cleaning it.
Well, yeah, I got to tell you, Peter, this whole thing is difficult to us to digest for a lot of people. You know, environmentalists specifically who just love this planet. You know, you, author of A Green Sky, Under a Green Sky and Life as We Do Not Know It. This has got to bother you too, huh?
Well, it does. And let's add one more thing to the equation. If, as we believe, this oil will be for a century there, because certainly all other oil spills have suggested that's the case, in the next century, we can expect a minimum of 3 feet of sea level rise. So we have it sort of, you know, at least it's only on the shoreline, we say, except with 3 feet of sea level rise, you pick up that oil and you start moving it inward. Year by year by year, we push that oil ever, ever inward as the sea rises. So you've got this really combination of nastiness. And guess what's causing the sea level to rise? The use of all the oil causing CO2 to go to the atmosphere. I don't know. It's almost grim humor, but oil is killing us with oil. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it sure it does. Next hour, I'll be talking with an expert about alternatives. But, you know, they'll continue to use oil. They'll continue to try to pump it and see what we're going to do in this case. Now, why is it so difficult to cap? Because it's 5,000 feet down. Is that the big problem?
Oh, this is absolutely the case. Early in my life, I was a deep sea diver. And then I started seeing the stats on that and went into academics. But even when you're working, as we used to do, at 100, 150 feet, the difficulties of working at that depth are unbelievable. Now they're down at 5,000 feet. And this is really pioneering technology. These deep, deep wells are only a few years old at most.
I mean,
this is something that they have just now started getting into. The Environmental Protection Agency, for reasons still to be explored, never went into these BP deep wells and actually gave them a clean bill of health. I mean, this thing scurried under the back door. Look, BP is about the most environmentally unfriendly oil company on the planet. And they are just now asking for drilling rights again in the high Arctic. And we've got this North Shore situation where a couple of years ago, BP was letting oil out there, doing nothing about it. They refused to clean it up. And now I hear that the CEO has said, no, we're going to cap our losses at $75 million. Well, we're talking $3 to $5 billion of taxpayers' money
exactly. That
should come from BP. And this guy says, no, not our fault.
Plus, we should take the well if they ever get it fixed. But that thing,
I don't know if they're going to get it fixed.
No, I don't think so either. That's true. Even if they cap it, they'll probably have to keep it that way for a while. But even that's dangerous. How long can a cap last?
You know? Well, no one's ever capped it like this before. I mean, we're really going into new territory here. And again, BP is just really backpedaling on exactly how much oil is coming out. So this is something that could go on for months or for years, because at that sort of depth, you've got so much pressure, you cannot put a human down there. It's got to be done completely robotically.
Yeah.
And the robotic, the degree of finesse you can do with a small claw going out of a submarine is nowhere anything like a human hand, where you can actually go down there, you can screw down enormous bolts and make a cover. You can't do that with the stuff they have there.
I always thought oil had to be pumped. So what's causing this to spew out?
It's the pressure. I mean, the fact that the oil is coming out of the ground in the first place because you've got this unbelievable overriding pressure, usually of land. But now you've got 5,000 feet of seawater on it. I mean, 5,000 feet is about 2,000, about 1,500 meters. With every 10 meters of the sea, you add an extra atmosphere on it. So there's 30 atmospheres that say 300 meters deep. At this level of depth, we're talking about 150 atmospheres of pressure. That pushing down on the crust and pushing down on the overall structure is more than enough to push that oil right out. It's a really strange place anyway. Most of the oil that's found down there is found next to a bunch of really strange deposits called salt deposits. These things are ancient, 20, 30 million year old salt that sits there. The oil is pocketed around them. You stick a tube down in it and it just flows out beautifully. The trouble is at great depth, you can't control it.
And I got to tell you, Peter, I'm a believer in the abiotic oil theory. I believe that this planet has lots of naturally made oil. It's here. I think it was in the crust and the mantle and all that, and that's where it is. For those who still believe that oil was formed by dead plants and dinosaurs, if that's the case, how did it get down there so far?
Well, if you've certainly got a lot of very smart people on your side. Thomas Gold was the man who really came up with this, and he actually a very smart guy. Also was the first to believe that there's a deep microbial biosphere, he thought there's as much life down there a mile deep to 2 miles deep as there is on the whole rest of the planet combined. That alone would certainly help you in the oil, but he also thought that it's even deeper that a lot of this oil is forming. Again, this is the abiotic oil formation theory that you just mentioned. No one's been able to disprove it. The Swedes, however, spent millions of bucks on the deepest well ever. They punched it apparently in the wrong kind of rock, which would never have oil anyway. But it's a really expensive proof to try to do this, to get a hole that deep. But we do know there's a whole lot more oil in very deep depths than we ever thought. The problem is, look what's happening when you go deep.
Right. But that does back up the abiotic theory. And, again, if this thing never runs dry, what does that tell you about oil?
Well, the scary thing is that there's a heck of a lot of oil in the Gulf. We know that. I mean, this is made Gulf Petroleum originally, and now it's got Texaco, the original Seven Sisters, all rich. It's also easy. Once you put that hole down there, the oil will migrate in from many different sides for a long way. And that's the scary thing about this. You've got this really deep hole, and now you've got lots of other oil all around it laterally. One hole coming out, lots of oil migrates to it. The way to slow down the flow would be to punch many more holes around there. The problem with that, it takes so long to drill a deep hole, and then you've also got the risk of the same darn thing happening.
All over the place.
All over the place.
Now what I'm trying to picture this, too. It's 5,000 feet down where they did where they drilled through.
Well, it's 5,000 feet, yeah, down, and then it's deeper into the rock.
All right, the pipe. There must be a huge pipe or pipes, right? 5,000 feet long, right?
That's right.
What's broken?
It was right down at the very base, actually. It isn't the pipe itself, but apparently from what I gather, and believe me, they're being very closed-mouthed about this, is that it was a crew error. Some guy on his shift just didn't quite pay attention to things, and that there was an overpressure. Part of the pipe just snapped off. It was in such a position right down to the base that it's away from where the cutoff valves are. They have a couple of ways to try to shut this off under normal circumstances.
This is like trying to re-pipe a broken water pipe, and you can't turn off the shutoff valve.
Yeah, well, imagine that you are sitting next to a fire truck that is blowing at maximum velocity, and you want to stick a cap into that fire hose that's blasting out with hundreds of pounds per square feet.
That'll blow it right back at you.
Well, that's exactly what they have to worry about. And so they're going to attempt to do this never-before-done, the dome that they're going to put down. And then they'll say, we'll just pump the oil out of the dome. Well, no one's ever done it for a very good reason, that this is only theoretical at best.
If for some reason they never stop this leak, and until the end of time, thousands and thousands of gallons a day spew out of that, what would happen?
Well,
they never stop it.
You would have oil going all the way from the big Gulf region in Florida, all the way across the panhandle of Florida, all the way across Louisiana, and then streak it all the way down to the coast of Texas. I mean, you would have oil.
Ever go all around the world?
No, I don't think so. I think sooner or later the ocean's a really big place. That is a huge coastline. Sooner or later, it will slow down out of there, unless you're right, unless if it's got this abiotic, then.
Yeah.
But no wells ever last forever. You can go to Los Angeles now. I don't know if you've ever seen all the wells around L.A.
Back
in the 20s and 30s, that was where the biggest oil strikes were. And all those wells now, after 50 years, have slowed down to no more than a barrel a day. They're still making the people own them rich, but they're called stripper wells.
Yeah.
This, too, eventually will just, I hate to use the word, peter out, and sooner or later, for a lot of different reasons, it will slow down. But look, these are wells in California that were pumped first hold in the 30s. And now here we are almost a century later, and they're still pumping oil out. That gives you a sense of how long this could go on.
Absolutely. This is a mess. Well, Peter, we'll take calls with you in just a moment here as we talk about the biological effect, and we'll get a perspective from you on just what's going on all around the planet too. I love your credentials, by the way. Yeah, you've done it all. What's your favorite thing of biology that you've done in your life?
Well, the last 3 years, I've been lucky enough to go to Antarctica. I've been digging up dinosaur fossils in Antarctica and trying to figure out what killed those off. I mean, the asteroid theory is the one that everybody loves the most, but we're seeing some really interesting changes just before the end of the age of dinosaurs in Antarctica. But you can't help but see that ice melting away down there. I mean, the places, even the 3 years I've been there, it's amazing how much it changes from year to year.
All right. I might ask you about the woolly mammoth that they found in Siberia with grass in its mouth, but it apparently had died and froze instantly. We'll be back in a moment. We'll take your phone calls with Peter Ward right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, David Bloom joins us as we talk about other alternatives to oil, followed by the final hour with Joshua P. Warren's Paranormal Moment. Hey, are you a Streamlink member yet? Well, you can be for just pennies a day. You get downloads, past archives, podcasting, iPhone apps, different apps we're working on, soon a webcam for our monthly chat, and just have some fun. Streamlink, part of Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, where with Peter Ward, we're going to take your phone calls the remaining part of this half hour. Let me ask you a question about that mammoth that froze in Siberia, had grass still in its mouth. What the heck happened to it to have it freeze that fast, Peter?
You know, this has always been one of the great mysteries. It not only had grass in its mouth, it had buttercups. Buttercups are a flower, pretty yellow little things in my lawn. I hate them. Buttercups are a flower that runs around in springtime, and there is no way in the world I could have buttercups on my lawn and fall into a crack anywhere and get deep frozen like that mammoth. I can't answer that. This is one of the great mysteries. Someone figured this out, and we'll all be better off. I mean, this is unexplainable.
All right, to the phones we go. We'll go to Mark, first of all, in Oakland, California, west of the Rockies. Mark, you're on Coast to Coast. Good morning.
Good morning. Hello, George. I have a question for Peter regarding the soil spill catastrophe.
Sure thing. Go ahead.
If they're even right telling us it's 220,000 gallons a day coming out and being a mile down, my question is if they can't re-concrete and seal this out, you know, the idea of threading the needle seems just crazy. If this oil just keeps coming out, won't it eventually go around Florida and go up the Gulf Stream and, for all we know, end up in Europe?
Well, it could. That's a great question.
It continues to leak for 50 years.
Well, it's a great question. Mm-hmm. I actually got some figures during the break. The great Alaska oil spill turned out to be, about 11 million gallons. This spill was estimated to be 10 million gallons on May 1st. And as you said, an extra 200,000 gallons per day since. So we got another million on top of it. But they're worried that we'll soon go not from 200,000, but to 2 million gallons today. So the Exxon spill covered 1,300 linear miles of coastline in Alaska. This thing shows no sign of slowing down. I mean, we're looking at 10 to 15 million gallons this week. But at the rate that it's going, I mean, that could be up to 100 million gallons. Now, in that particular case, you do have the entire coastline, again, from Texas all the way to Florida. The prevailing currents are such that things do spin around. It would have to be a lot of strange gyrations to get that oil into the Gulf Stream. You have to go all the way around the tip of Florida. It's much more likely that it would work its way due to prevailing winds heading more towards Texas. But it would certainly just reduce all of the low swampland in that entire area. If you've ever been there, I mean, there's not a hill in sight. That land is just sea level. All of it is going to get inundated with this oil. Now, plants do not do well in oil. Plants and roots just don't do well. So we're going to start looking at a dead zone that would be the entire length of the Gulf Coast.
And, you know, this being 5,000 feet down, the water pressure is so strong it could crush a submarine down there. So I don't know if this little rig's going to work.
Well, there's certainly any military sub wouldn't do very well there. The deep diving subs, they're using unmanned submersibles so far. I think they're going to have to really give that up. The reason they're using unmanned submersibles is that BP refuses to pay. I mean, look at the Alaska oil spill. They were fined $5 billion. In the end, they paid $500 million because under the Bush administration, the judges said, well, that's just not fair to poor Exxon. And so they cut it to a tenth. We are already billing BP for $3 billion. I mean, that's the cost so far. That's what Obama has estimated. And the head, again, has said, I'll pay $75 million and not a penny more. They're not going to go for a deep submarine. It would be a manned submersible, and that's exactly what you need. And I wouldn't want to be on that sub trying to do this work, by the way.
Do they own that rig down there? They own that oil well, or do they just lease it?
It's a lease. They own the hardware,
right.
But they lease the land that it's on, and they paid actually a very small sum to get those leases comparative to what they're pulling out of it. So it's just really spooky about what we're dealing with here. Now, let's just step back a little bit. This was not the only deep oil well that's out there. Most of those rigs are getting 35 to 50,000 gallons a day, up to that many barrels per day from the rigs already in place. You are one Katrina away from 10 or 15 or 20 of these things going off. I mean, these things did not exist when Katrina came through. This is a really brand new technology. And now, I mean, we're looking at a globally warmed world where hurricanes will get bigger. And you have these Category 5 storms running into these things. What are we thinking?
Where's Red Adair when we need him, huh?
I remember him. Yeah, he used to be able to put those things out, but that's a different ball of wax, isn't it?
It sure
is. As it was flaming, but this is underwater oil under enormous pressure.
Our first-time caller, Douglas, is in Houston, Texas, home of Billy Gibbons from ZZ Top. Hey, Douglas, go ahead.
Hello, George. I want to talk to your guest about possibly taking and putting a sleeve on the outside of that well at the base level, forcing it down on surrounding the pre-existing pipe, and taking some plasticize and pumping concrete down mixed with that, you know, from the surface to seal it off around and cap it, you know, just load the pipe up with it. What do you think about that idea?
Well, I'm not an engineer, but I have done a lot of just shallow water diving work, salvage diving. I worked for the ferry boats. I worked on the bridges out here. But I do know that leverage underwater is the hard thing. You've got a small submersible. How would a small submersible have the pressure and weight to be able to push against that to get the sleeve on? See, that's your problem, is that you've got so much force coming out. A small sub just will never have the leverage, never. You'd need thousands of tons of weight to come down on that thing. This is why they're trying to do this dome. The dome itself will have much greater weight, and there's no other way except some gigantic, heavy edifice, because the small sub is just get pushed out of the way. You're totally correct. I mean, what you say is how you could stop it if there weren't as much pressure coming out. In a shallow well, you could do that, not here.
All we need next is Mother Nature to have another volcano erupt, earthquakes, and God knows what's left.
Well, luckily that's not earthquake country, and it's not volcano country, but it's hurricane country. We got enough mess for the hurricanes. I mean, believe me, they could do the damage all you need.
Next up, we go to Carl in Atoka, Oklahoma, east of the Rockies. Hey, Carl, go ahead.
Hello, George and Peter.
How do you do?
Listen, I know what killed the dinosaurs. I know what killed the giant ungulates and the woolly mammoths, the mastodons, and so on.
We got them.
It was caused by a collapse of the Earth's gravity to the weaker residual gravity of the Earth's matter makeup. And it was caused as the moon, its gravity, desynchronized with the Earth's core. The Earth's off-center core is pulled off-center by the moon. The Earth rotates around the core and generates our internal heat and our gravity, stronger gravity that we have. When those events take place, within 2 minutes' time, the atmosphere expands. The Earth's rotation rate increases because the centrifugal force increases as the rotation rate increases. There's no more friction of rotating around the core. The meteors impact the Earth in their millions per day, leaving the iridium and tektite layers, other layers. The expanded atmosphere flash freezes all of the Earth except for the areas at or near the massive volcanism that's released.
Now, what do you think of this theory? Carl called me a month ago during Open Lines with this theory. Who knows? Maybe, Peter, huh?
Well, here's the one hole in it that I can see. A, it sounds like Velikovsky, and he was a real interesting guy, Emmanuel Velikovsky.
Sure. Yep.
But the one thing you said about the iridium, you know, I've been at 20 or 30 of these so-called KT boundary sites. I spent 10 or 15 years of my life doing it. I'd still be there, except the grant money ran out. I was working on the coast of France and Spain. Beautiful. But you could see that iridium layer. I mean, it's just very evident in the rocks. And it's just there. I mean, you've got to figure out some way to explain why a one-inch thick layer would have all the iridium, whether there's none below or none above. I mean, this has caused special pleading, because you're right. The iridium only comes from the material of comets, and you're right. Asteroids and comets are hitting the atmosphere all the time. There's tiny little particles called Brownlee particles that my co-author Don Brownlee here from the UW name. That stuff's falling on us, but you've got a several billion time concentration of that one-inch layer. So you've got to come up with that, or your theory doesn't hold water.
You're a biologist. You're an astronomer.
Started out as a geologist.
What do you think about life out there on other planets somewhere in the universe, ours?
I think it's almost everywhere. Now, I wrote a book called Rare Earth, and what we tried to say, this is Brownlee and myself, is that complex life is probably fairly rare because you've got to have a planet that can last a long time. But simple life may be everywhere. I mean, the interesting thing about this oil spill, you're talking about petroleum. We could have all the petroleum we would ever want if we could just get to Titan. On Titan,
yes,
it rains petroleum. There are ethane lakes. If we get a pipe from there, we wouldn't need these damn oil wells.
And again, the abiotic theory, no dinosaurs and plant over there, right?
No, there isn't. And there's a whole lot of hydrocarbons. And if you have life there, because it's so cold, a colleague of mine says that's where you'd find true silica life. I'd love to come back and give you my theory of silica life. It's called silanes. At very cold temperatures, silica can form what carbon does here. The organic molecules on Titan would be silica, not carbon. And you've got a very different kind of life. It's fascinating to think about.
I'd like to do a life in space show with you, Peter.
I'd love to do it. I wrote a book about it, and I know, at least I used to know something, but I'm getting old, starting to lose the brain cells.
Oh, they regenerate, haven't you heard?
I wish we were like the oil in the crust. Oh, boy.
Fayetteville, Pennsylvania, I do believe. Let's go to our wildcard line. Go ahead, Tom.
Yes, sir. I would like to know why couldn't a well be caved in? You do with water wells and stuff when you're done with them, you cave them in. Why couldn't a sub launch two torpedoes, maybe three torpedoes, get the number crunchers to figure out where to hit them, and just cave the things in?
Yeah, and blow it up. What do you think about that, Peter? I was thinking about that, too.
Yeah, well, that's a great question. But the thing is, it's really a misnomer, because we have been led by all kinds of cartoons and movies and things to think of oil sitting down there in a pool. It's not. The oil is sitting in a layer of rock, incompressible rock. And the reason that we can get it out and it flows out so readily is, because of this high pressure. If that rock were sitting here under our normal pressure, no oil would come out at all. But it's the fact that we have a pipe extending from the low-pressure atmosphere we're in down into the high pressure that sucks the oil out between the grains. It's in a sandstone. Every void of that sandstone has oil in it. So there's no cave. You could send all the rockets down you want. It wouldn't do a thing. This is just the consequence of high pressure down there, low pressure up here, sucking oil out of a rock.
Peter, did they know how to drill there? Because you're talking about a heck of an investment.
You are, but actually it's not that hard. They've done seismic imaging down there, and oil rises. So let's say that you have the rock, it's not flat rock, but it bows upward and it bows down. Where it rises up and rises down is called an anticline, and the oil always goes to the highest part. You can see those from sonar imaging. You just drill every place where, you know, the rocks are all bent all over the bottom of the oceans. You just find those strata that have a little bow up and drill it, and bingo. That's all you've got to do. All they're doing now is they're going into deeper water. But they can clearly see where it is. They can find it easily. The question is, can they control it? And the answer is no.
Let's go to Fullerton, California. Naomi's waiting for us. Hi, Naomi. Go ahead.
Oh, good evening, George. Good evening, hi, Mr. Ward. I have a question. Since you've had experience in deep sea diving and all of that, do you think the pressure at 5,000 feet, or even going down to 5,000 feet, will crush the concrete structure that they're trying to cap the well with?
Only if it has any sort of air pockets in it. The thing about water is that to the greatest depths of the ocean, water is incompressible. You just can't squeeze water any tighter than it already is. When you make concrete, you're putting sand in there, but the concrete originally, when it sets with water in it. Every void has water that then changes to hard rock. There's no gas within it at all. So once you've set your concrete, you can't crush it. And unless there's a void, there's nothing to crush, because water and concrete are incompressible under just the very puny depths our oceans are. Look, if you went to Europa, 100-mile deep ocean, you're starting to see in the bottom of that ocean some very different physics. But on our oceans, 10 to 14 miles deep at the most, no, you're going to be fine with the concrete. Great question, though.
Oh, thank you very much.
All right, Naomi, and Tina's our first-time caller in Athens, Georgia. Go ahead, Tina.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you, Jim. I'm enjoying this conversation, and it just made me think of my father just yesterday. He's 80 years old, and he was coming up with an idea. He says, why couldn't they get, like, a really big ship with, like, a vacuum and start vacuuming up the oil and containing it?
That's a great question. Let me take a shot at it. None of us, I think, can really comprehend is the volume that's coming out. I mean, my vacuum, when I suck up stuff, little stuff comes here and there. Imagine vacuuming up millions of gallons of anything. I mean, what size vacuum would you need? You'd need a bigger vacuum than anybody's ever invented in history. It's just the sheer amount of this stuff that's making this problem.
We'll call David Orrick.
Yeah, there we go. I need the oil vacuum, please.
Yeah.
Two million gallons per day.
He's probably got one of those. You never know with that.
You're right, caller. The principle's correct. I mean, that would be the way to do it. It's just the mass, the size of this thing is really hard to deal with.
What's your gut tell you about all this, Peter? A disaster?
Yeah, well, it is a disaster. And I think the big disaster will be 10 years from now when we see what this oil is doing. I heard one of your promos about weird creatures coming out of the deep sea. Well, here's a case where we may start seeing really interesting new mutants coming out of the microbes in this mud down there.
I think you're going
to have a biological Frankenstein lab going on in that mud once this oil hits it.
Hey, definitely. Call producer Lisa and let's book you for a full show on just life in space and get some of your thoughts and ideas and what they might look like and silicate look. That would be
I'd love to. I think I've been on the show now 6 or 7 times over the years. I love coming
on. Have. That reminds me of like glass-looking creatures whenever I hear that.
Yep. Well, that's what the Titan life would look like.
All right.
Hit them with a rock hammer and crash down they go.
You got it. Thanks, Peter.
Appreciate all right. Thanks so much.
On the show. That's his insight into this biological disaster. Next hour, David Bloom joins us on Coast to Coast AM with some alternative energy ideas. And then the final hour of the show, Joshua P. Warren joins us with his paranormal moment, and he'll be telling us how to train yourself to experience ghosts.